Hello, thank you so much for coming. I'm Professor Richard Canning from the English and Creative Writing programs, and I'm delighted, of course, to welcome today a very honoured guest, Professor Edmund White. And I'm going to just read from the screen in case, because I would miss fabulous things out from your past. We have about an hour, and we're going to then break, and the kind people from Bloomsbury who allowed us to set this up have got some copies of the latest memoir, Inside a Pearl, which Edmund will read from shortly, at a very special price, remarkably, a discounted price. I think they're doing them at £10. So in an hour when we finish, there'll be time to buy those if you have cash. Sorry, that's very old-fashioned, isn't it? And signings and so on. And then we need to make sure Ed is on his way back to London because he has a big event at the South Bank tonight. So this is Professor Edmund White, one of America's foremost novelists. I'm so sorry for reading this. It looks very uninspired, doesn't it? But it is my own words. They're all my own words. As well as being an acclaimed biographer, memoirist is the word, and playwright. His literary career began over four decades ago in 1973 with the publication of the novel Forgetting Eleanor, which was praised by the Russian-American novelist Vladimir Nabokov, amongst others. A book which was followed by the co-authored Joy of Gay Sex, a bestseller. A second novel, Nocturnes for the King of Naples, a travel book, States of Desire, Travels in America, Gay America, and the novel Caracol. White is today author of some 29 books to date, including the auto-fictional trilogy for which he is perhaps best known, consisting of A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony. His biography of Jean Genet won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and White followed it with two short lives of the French novelist Marcel Proust and poet Arthur Rimbaud. His memoirs, meanwhile, include My Lives, City Boy, My Life in New York During the 60s and 70s, and now Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. Shorter memoirs include The Flaneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris, and Our Paris, Sketches from Memory. There's a theme developing. He is professor of creative writing at Princeton and presently lives in Manhattan, but for a decade and a half was resident in Paris. He moved there age 43 in 1983. This is from your book jacket, so. Speaking no French and knowing just two people in the city. By the time he left in 1998, he was fluent in French and a recipient of the French Order of Arts and Letters. He made the acquaintance of just about everybody in the creative circles in Paris, from Yves Saint Laurent to Catherine Deneuve, and from Michel Foucault to Marie-Claude de Brunhoff, a central figure in the memoir Inside a Pearl, around whom all radiates. Maybe we'll talk about her. Professor White is making just a few select appearances in the UK, including Hay Book Festival and London South Bank Centre tonight, but graciously agreed to add one more stop, his only campus visit, to talk to us here today in Northampton. He'll read first from Inside a Pearl, and I've mentioned the copies available afterwards, and we'll do a Q&A for as long as may seem interesting, and take questions also from the floor. I'm sure you'd all like to give your thanks for Ed White finding time to be with us today. So let's begin by thanking so much.
Thank you. I just thought I'd read a little bit about when I first went to Paris. Of course, I'd lied to the editors of Vogue, who'd given me a job, and told them I spoke perfect French. My first assignment was to interview Eric Rohmer, the most intellectual of all French film directors, an elderly genius obsessed by shop girls. And yet, in 1984, he was only 64, which naturally seemed ancient to me then. I was 43. Someone had said that seeing his movies was kind of like watching paint dry. Romer, I had to tape, I rehearsed my questions carefully with my translator. I had to tape Romer's answers since I had no idea what he was saying, which of course meant that I couldn't pose any follow-up questions to the provocative and original things it turned out that he was saying. In Hollywood movies, the star absorbs and perfects the foreign language seamlessly and in a matter of days, since language plays no part in the plot. But my fear of daunting linguistic encounters only added to my mounting agoraphobia. I seldom left the apartment. I'd sit in a chair and rehearse what I might say, what Romer might say, and how I'd answer, and hours of invented conversation would play out in my head. I'd think something in English and immediately try to translate it into French. I'd practice translation so much that I could say many things, at least the sort of things that typically I'd say in my own language. Comprehension, however, was another thing altogether. After I'd present my my own carefully displayed sentence like a diamond necklace on black velvet, the other speaker, the French person, would throw his sentence at me like a handful of wet sand. It would sting so badly that I'd wince, and an instant later I would wonder what had just happened to me. Perhaps worst of all, I'd failed to grasp little nice things shopkeepers or neighbors were saying about the weather or the wild strawberries. Pleasant comments I was unable to acknowledge or engage with.
Great, thank you so much. I think for anyone who's ever met Ed before socially or heard him speak, the idea that you started with there of starting over in Paris, but because of the language issue, being a recluse, becoming a recluse, I mean, for those of us that know you a bit, it's unimaginable, really.
So, well, I'm sort of reclusive. I mean, probably more than you would think so. I mean, I think when I come to London, I like to see everybody, but at home, I in New York, I can spend weeks alone.
Yeah. You spoke in this novel, a memoir you wrote about this, and previously also talked of the leaving of New York in the context of AIDS, and we said we'd touch on this and then kind of maybe put it behind us in case it's too grim, but that, you know, AIDS was a reason for taking...
Well, AIDS first attacked, first evidence itself in 1981, and then we founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which was the first and still the biggest, it's like the Terence Higgins Trust, I suppose, and I was the first president of it, but I wasn't a very good president, so I was happy to quit that right away. Mm-hmm. And then I guess I thought I would never write again if I kept being an activist. So that was one reason why I moved to Paris in 83, but it almost instantly caught up with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it wasn't really an AIDS holiday, because friends of mine began to die right away, like Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. And then I sat in on the first meetings organized by Foucault's survivor, Daniel Defer. He just wrote a book called A Life in Politics, and it's a series of interviews, really. And he says that when I went to their first meetings, I said, well, you should find a president who is very good-looking, because gay people like that, and they're always attracted. So he said, we found a wonderful top doctor who was also like a model. He was so handsome. So, and he cites all that without realizing how frivolous I was being. But
You also spoke about taking up the challenge of writing this long and substantial biography of Jean Genet as a sort of holiday from the other obvious subject matter at the time. I don't know if
Well, I started it in 87, a year after Jean Genet died. I don't know if any of you know him or his work, but he was he wrote five novels in about 5 years. And it's probably the most intense creation of, I think, in French literary history. I mean, it's very, very beautiful work. And then he stopped that. Then he did nothing for 10 years. Then he wrote three great plays, The Blacks, The Screens, and The Balcony.
Oh.
And then he was silent for about 20 years, and then he became politically active as a defender of the Black Panthers in America and the Palestinians. And then he died. Anyway, he just died the year before I began my biography. And my favorite editor in New York had called me and said, do you know anyone who would do a Genet biography? And I said, me. But I thought it would take only 2 or 3 years. And 7 years later, I was still slogging through it. And he was the most secretive man. And not like most literary biographies are about middle-class people whose mothers doted on them and saved every scrap of paper they ever touched when they were children. And then all their friends were other writers, and they were endlessly exchanging letters. And every time they turned around, another article was written about them in the Guardian or something. And but Genet was a foundling and grew up in a very obscure part of France, and then was a juvenile delinquent and was in prison for years and years. So for until he was about 35, he was constantly in and out of prison. And it's very hard to find prisoners because they die early, usually. And then if you find them, they won't talk to you. And then if, especially if you have a funny foreign accent, and then they, if they do talk to you, you can't rely on it. And they want to be paid. So it's very different from the normal literary biography. I mean, we didn't even know where he was from. He would never tell anybody the name of his village. And so, I mean, I was like 5 years into it, and my publisher said, well, I hope you're coming along. Oh, yes, I've written most of it. I hadn't even started. And I saw a bus barreling along in New York, and I thought, if I just step in front of this bus, I won't have to write this book or give the money back. But but then one day an American friend of mine came to me with this newspaper, which was published for the people from the Morvan, which is where he grew up, which is kind of like, I don't know, like Kentucky would be in America. It's very central and primitive. And and the banner headline said, "My school chum, Jean Genet." And so finally, I knew where he was from, and I went to the village and I interviewed 13 people who had known him. And they were not readers, and they barely knew his reputation. So they were kind of uncontaminated witnesses. And Sartre had written a big book about Genet called Saint Genet, in which he had said that he was caught as a criminal when he was still a child and driven out of the village with rocks. All that turned out to be wrong. And he was actually number one student in the whole county and doted on by his foster mother. And he did filch little things like erasers and marbles and things, but nobody took that too seriously. And so we got a very different picture of what his life had been like from the one he had told everybody. I think that's why he wouldn't tell people where he grew up, because he wanted to present his own version of his life, which was, and to be fair, he always called those things novels. So they weren't really meant to be memoirs or trustworthy autobiographies.
You spoke at the time about the project as also involving sort of attraction and opposites. I mean, perhaps describing yourself then as a non-criminal or non-liar, or and I was just tempted to link in Proust and Rambo that came after and ask about the, you know, attraction of biographical subjects, particularly if they're deceitful or unreliable in that way.
Well, I mean, people used to ask me, did you ever meet Genet? Because I could have met him, because he died 3 years after I arrived in France. But I said, no, I knew he would have hated me. He hated white people, he hated writers, he hated other homosexuals, he hated Americans, and he hated middle-class people, so I would have lost him all 5 pounds. So I never bothered to get to know him. And, I mean, I interviewed Paul Bowles in Morocco, and he said, for the same reason, he never bothered to get to know him, because he just knew that Genet would resent him and dislike him. And but I think that Arthur Rimbaud, the poet from the 19th century, who I wrote a little short biography of him, and he had a very similar life in a way. I think France must have had a wonderful school system, public school system, because Genet never went beyond age 12 to school, and Rimbaud never went beyond age 16, and yet they were two of the best writers France ever turned out, and not in some sort of primitive way, but very classical, traditional, well-educated writers. And I think that they're in a way similar. But Proust was entirely different, because Proust was from a very privileged family with a Jewish mother whose Jewishness he always denied. And he was himself, well, all three were homosexual, but Proust always denied that he was homosexual. And and in his books, I mean, somebody who was half or all Jewish, if you think that the mother's religion is what determines in the eyes of Jews whether they're Jewish or not. So he was Jewish and he was gay, but he always pretended to be Catholic and heterosexual. And he was congratulated in his own day by many critics for being courageous enough to deal with this terrible gay subject matter. And and he accepted that sort of praise. I mean, he was really quite, I think, deceitful on a superficial level. But then when you start writing people's biographies, I think it's silly to just try to unmask them. You know, you try to understand why they distorted things. Like in Genet's case, he went to Spain as a vagrant, and it was the heart of the Depression. And he would have to scramble all day long to get one onion to eat or something. I mean, it was desperate, desperate poverty. And so he would say in the Thief's Journal that he lived 2 years in Spain, and Spain was engraved on his heart as this land of misery. But in fact, he was only there 2 months. But I think if he'd said 2 months, it would have sounded sort of trivial. But and for how much you probably would suffer as a vagrant in Spain at the height of its poverty and your poverty, you have to say 2 years to lend it the requisite dignity and importance. And I tried to think in those terms when writing. I think it's silly when biographies just try to unmask writers, especially when they call their work fictional. Anyway, to start with, that's Proust did.
I was going to move on to talk about place and home, and just sketch out maybe the obvious, perhaps many of you know it, that that you grew up in the Midwest, and as the autofictions reveal, and as City Boy, the memoir about New York, reveals, you know, came good in that city, in literary terms, then decamped for Paris. You also spent some time lived in Rome for a while, didn't you?
In the Assembly,
short a while, yeah. And so, just, I suppose I wanted to ask silly biographer type questions as to, you know, whether you knew when you arrived in Paris, whether you had a conception of the time period, you know, that it might be.
I'd won a fellowship, and I thought I would just for a year, and I thought I would just stay there a year. And I had lunch with a friend of a friend, and she told me, oh yeah, I thought 1 year too, but I've been here 20 years now. And it's really the land of lotus eating, Paris, and you'll just stay forever. And it did go on for but I had no idea when I first arrived that I would stay so long.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great things in this book, but actually something which characterizes all of the memoirs, is the quality of friendship that comes across as an abiding kind of theme. And I mentioned that this figure who I met a few times, and of course is the center of the book, Marie Claude, and you devote a lot of space in the book to talking about qualities of friendship and how the French, as it were, approached you and befriended you.
Well, I mean, the cliche that people say about Americans is that everything you get to know on the first encounter is all you'll ever know, because Americans warm up to you very quickly, but they don't become deep as friends. I think it's silly to generalize about nationalities, but I do think that the French, who are rather guarded when you first meet them, once you pierce all those lines of defense, that, and you become a real friend, that they have a kind of cult of friendship, and it's sacred to them. And they don't have more than three or four friends, but that friend could call you up at 3 a.m. and say, give me all your money, and they would. I mean, they would do anything for you, which is not quite the way Americans are. I mean, Americans are very friendly when you meet them, and then you call them the next day and they don't even know who you are.
Well, things have moved on.
Yes.
But you also say in the book that Americans will, you know, tell you everything about themselves at the first meeting.
First meeting, yes.
We're risking generalizations, but why not?
But I think, you know, I've had seat partners on planes in America, and they'll tell me all about their suicide attempts and their... Too much information, really, and the French people would take a long time to get to that stage. But of course, they have lots of markers for levels of intimacy. I mean, you go from connaissance, an acquaintance, to a copain, a buddy, to an ami. But there are at least those three stages, and then you go from the formal you to the informal you. And they're much more likely to sustain the voo for years than the Italians, let's say. Italians, as soon as you could use somebody's first name, oh, hello, Roger, you know, you would switch immediately to the informal you. But French people, I've known ladies who of a certain age who were friends for 20 years, and they were still calling each other Madame this and Madame that, and saying vous. You know, it's very
formal. They say Silvio Berlusconi called our queen by her first name. That was the start of that spectacular falling out.
Oh.
You don't do that.
Liz, she called her?
Yeah. That's not appropriate on a first meet. Good. We're going to risk generalizations a bit more, but another great compliment to the French that you put in the memoir is to talk about them as, what's the right word? The ultimate in kind of Darwinist, in changeability or reconstruction, that they get the fastest.
Oh, I think the French can change their ideas and attitudes quicker, certainly, than any other country I've known. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're always trying to stay up to date. I mean, it is a country ruled by fashion. I remember at the time of the French bicentennial, I did a program for the BBC with Germaine Greer and J.H. Plum, the historian. And they hated the parade that Goud had done for the centennial because they kept worrying about what was the symbolism of it all. And I said, well, there's no... I mean, there were giant people in Russian muffs skating and they were being held aloft by... anyway, it was, I said, but it's fashion. You know, it's supposed to look beautiful. It doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't get past that. And then I think in general, a lot of English people see the French as superficial.
N'est-ce pas? I was just thinking casual recollections suggest that our own Prime Minister represented, or we might say misrepresented, all of us at that time, but she had a stern air of disapproval.
Oh, they loved her in France. They called her the Iron Lady.
Yeah.
Dame de fer.
Yeah. Mitterrand said the look of Marilyn Monroe and the smile of Caligula didn't...
Oh, that's great.
Backhanded. Yeah. But he caught her. Yeah. Back in the day. Okay, well, let's talk about the relationship between different genres. Not everybody may know that Ed has also been a very celebrated playwright. I mentioned the three prose genre, but playwriting we can also throw into the mix. And I just wondered maybe a sort of elementary question about how the form, emerged in each individual case, or whether the drift or movement between memoir and fiction and autofiction, how does an idea
I think all those things are much closer than people imagine. Memoir, fiction, I mean, there are obviously differences, but I think playwriting is probably like poetry. It's something completely apart. I mean, I have many really great novelists like Saul Bellow have written horrible plays. And I mean, they're so boring. And I think in general, novelists, no matter how much skill they have, they seldom have a success in the theater because they depend upon rhetoric and beautiful language, which is boring. And when people talk that much and then they answer that much, it's awful. And so I don't know. I was lucky enough to live with actors from the very beginning and to be interested in the theater. I think you have to kind of really... I think the best playwrights are actors like Shakespeare and Molière, and the worst playwrights are very bookish kind of writers. But
you told me Picasso had written a play.
Yes. But
stick to the day job.
But I think, I mean, obviously with the memoir and the novel, your contract with the reader is very different because, you know, I hate the phrase creative nonfiction because that sounds like a euphemism for lying, I think. You know, I think that in a memoir you should just say the truth and nothing but the truth as best you recall it. And obviously you get some things wrong, but you try to get everything right. Whereas in a novel, if you call it a novel, you're quite free to change, to turn 10 boyfriends into 2 and to collapse 5 years into 1. And, you have to simplify things. But I think it's not just that you have to do a novel. Somehow I think a novel should be representative. Or so like when I wrote A Boy's Own Story, I in real life, I was a very eccentric teenager, and I'd had maybe 500 partners, sexual partners, by the time I was 16, and I had, and I was sort of precocious intellectually as well, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do that because nobody will identify with a freak like that, so I'll just have them be really shy and kind of and dumb them down a little bit. And and more people will identify. But I think that you almost have an obligation to do that. Whereas in a memoir, you can present yourself. You're obliged to present yourself, warts and all, you know, and talk about all the crazy things you've actually done in your life, which would seem strange or bizarre or distracting and all.
Yeah. What about others? Because as is commonly understood in both in the fictions and also in the memoirs, you've obviously sketched a whole range of people, some deceased, some still alive, some stay friends, some love the portrayals, others don't. Is there a calculation, isn't the right word, but is the response that you get from the living always what you expect? Or
no, I mean, you're oftentimes surprised because I think other writers tend to be rather forgiving of disobliging portraits. I mean, they'll say, oh, well, I've written things like that too, that, and anyway, it's sort of fun. But regular people hate their portraits. It's like somebody used to say about a portrait in a painting, is that a portrait is a painting in which something is wrong with the mouth. And I think this in a portrait in words, people always dislike it. And I think it sounds a little philosophical to put it this way, but I think people constantly are in a state of becoming. They're always imagining that, yes, I'm chubby now, but I'll be thin in 2 years. Or, yes, I haven't learned Greek yet, but I will. You know, so then if you do a picture of them as their actual being, not their becoming, and you give them no future, you only give them a past and a present, they feel somehow cheated and misrepresented and wounded, I think.
Both Churchill and Somerset Maugham, did they both hand back those portraits by Graham Sutherland? I'm not saying you're Graham Sutherland, but there was too much truth in that, you know, portraiture to take a.
I think only royalty can accept the truth, like the Goya subjects. Yeah.
Oh yeah, did they love those paintings?
Yeah, they did. They didn't mind they had goiters and big noses because they did.
Well, it wasn't challenging their right to that monarchy and position.
No,
I suppose. Yeah, yeah. What about the idea of self-portrayal then between fiction and non-fiction? You made a clear distinction as to maybe the way that you approached it in the auto-fictions and how you now approach it in the memoirs. There, most of the material isn't replicated, though some things are. But could you say anything more, particularly about Boy's Own Story and the trilogy, about that? That what-if quality, that the things you changed and so on, because I was very struck that even back when it was, you know, the first publication, many critics did respond in that way that you'd imagined, talking about the universality of it and the accessibility and the emotions of what everyone felt. And then there were readers like me that just thought, this kid is too weird, you know. This was before I knew you.
No, I was always surprised by the success of Boy's Own Story, which was still a very small success, but because I thought the boy is, even though I've talked about normalizing him, he was fairly weird and rather unpleasant because he betrays a teacher at the end of the book, and somebody once told me that's why they never made a movie out of it. Because of the horrible ending. But I think that I have this theory that there'll be an empty ecological niche, that people want there to be a book that will fit into that niche. And in my case, it was a coming out story. I mean, since then, there have been millions of books about coming out. I just read a great one called Maggie and Me about this,
the Scottish one.
Yeah, the Scottish one.
Damien Barr.
Yeah. Damien Barr. And I thought it was terrific. And But I was lucky to get there first. And one of the things I tried to do many times in my life is to get there first. I mean, I wrote the first gay travel book, the first gay sexual manual, the first gay coming out novel. And then even recently I wrote a book called Jack Holmes and His Friend, which to my mind, or I'm probably wrong, you'll tell me, but I think it was one of the first books about a gay man's friendship with a straight man that went over 3 decades. And that seemed to me, I mean, there are books about schoolboys falling in love with other boys, but this kind of grown-up, hopeless love affair, which also blends into a friendship. Anyway, that seemed to me something that one observes all the time in life, but that had never been written about. And I think there are tons of other subjects that have not been touched yet.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to ask about Jack Holmes and His Friend, because it is a new subject or a new approach, and I thought you might just mention sort of arrangement or agreement with John Irving, the heterosexual American writer. You both decided to do that, or you challenged one another, or was it by coincidence? No.
Well, we email each other about 2 or 3 times a week. This is the man who wrote The World According to Garp, and he's completely heterosexual, but he has a gay son whom he really adores and who's very talented as an actor and a writer. And so, I don't know, we became good friends because I think the son first discovered my writing and then introduced his father to it, and then gradually we became friends. And he was working on a book called...
In One Person.
In One Person. My mind, I'm sorry. And so anyway, but it had bisexual themes in it, and we didn't give pages to each other to read until we'd finished. Mm-hmm. But we were constantly sort of discussing in a friendly way how we were progressing and what we were thinking about.
Yeah. They're really striking and compelling to read alongside one another. I mean, really, they're nothing... It's a series of contrasts, but it's two writers tackling not even the same, but a similar idea. I just thought the idea that it was a kind of compact, but not exactly. No.
Well, I don't think John Irving... I mean, he lives in Vermont in a very remote place, and I'm not sure he has that many writer friends. But I live in New York, so I have a lot of them. But anyway, we've certainly grown very attached to each other.
Yeah, yeah. You've also, by now, also sort of been written about. I mean, in the end, you become, a writer who's acclaimed, like you, comes to feature in other people's accounts and so on. And I wondered whether your experience of that, I mean, I was thinking of your nephew, Keith Fleming, back in the day, who wrote about a very strange story, if any of you don't know it, that Ed sort of took on his own nephew and brought him up in New York. Very particular story that is. And just whether the experience of being written about by others, then in turn informed the way that you took on memoir or represented other people.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think I've been too influenced by it. And I must say I'm not the most careful reader of books about me. Somebody once asked Genet why he never wanted to discuss his novels later in life, and he said, "I don't want to resemble myself," which I mean, it's kind of interesting as a response, because I think that you don't want to, you want to write something new, or you don't want to just... do your greatest hits, and you also don't want to. I mean, I'm writing a novel now that's entirely made up. But I've done that several times. I've written two historical novels, where of course you do research in the period, but you don't write about yourself. You're writing about other people. And I think I've pretty well covered my life, and I don't really want to write another memoir, except I'm planning one about a life of reading books, you know, the books that mattered in your life. I think that'd be fun to do. But otherwise, I'm interested in making things up now and being a real, what I call real novelist, you know, where you actually think things up. But that requires a lot of daydreaming. I mean, you have to lie on a couch and think and think and think and daydream, and to think up the plot. And it's what Flaubert called his marinade. He was always lying on the couch daydreaming, and I think it's true that when you make up characters and you make up situations, you have to think, well, now, if her husband said that, what would she do? And, you know, you try to base it on your own knowledge of human psychology and your observations, but that you think they should ring true. Or sometimes you'll hear a curious anecdote that is very striking, and you think, oh, I could put that in a book.
You chose real people, though, and writers in both cases in those historic fictions. You know, Stephen Crane in A Hotel to Dream, and Fanny Trollope, you know, maybe not on everybody's reading list, but back in the day.
But the mother of Trollope.
Yeah. So what was the appeal in particular of... but then, as you say, absolutely reimagined, fantasized. I don't know if there was any...
Well, let me just take the Stephen
Crane, well, and the prostitute, the boy prostitute.
There was Stephen Crane, who was famously heterosexual author and very handsome and appealing, and everybody liked him. And he died at age 29 from TB. But at one point, according to one friend of his, there's only one journal entry, this friend said that that Crane had begun to write a novel about a boy prostitute whom he'd met in New York. It was going to be a companion piece to his book, Maggie, Girl of the Streets, about a girl prostitute. And he got well into this book, and Hamlin Garland, who was a very macho friend of his, said, "Are you crazy? If you publish this, your career will be destroyed." This is 1890, you know, so he tore it up. But I thought it would be fun to imagine what the book would have been like had he written it. And so I tried to not recreate it, because there was nothing to go on, but to create it out of whole cloth, really. And so I think that's a good, or at least it appeals to me in writing historical fiction, is trying to imagine these big lacunae in the lives of people who otherwise are well documented, but there are certain crucial moments in their lives which we don't know anything about, and I think that's interesting to write about. I'm toying with the idea of writing a historical novel about Mozart's librettist, Lorenzo da Ponte, who had such a crazy life, because he was born near Venice in a village as a Jew. He converted to Christianity. He became a priest. He then had too many democratic ideas and played around with girls too much, so he was defrocked. Then he went to Vienna and wrote a whole bunch of operas, including the three greatest ones by Mozart, Don Giovanni, The Marriage of Figaro, and Così fan tutte. And then he came to London, went bankrupt as a bookseller, boarded a boat to go to America, where he was a greengrocer in New Jersey. And he says in his memoirs, "I look at these hands that are handing out pieces of cheese and snuff and everything to people, and I think these are the hands that wrote Don Giovanni." But anyway, he had an amazing life. He became the first professor of Italian at Columbia University in New York, and he produced the first New World production of Don Giovanni, and but 35 years after he'd written it. So the whole thing is really quite crazy. But he's a terrible writer, unlike his very good friend Casanova, who's such a wonderful, entertaining writer. Da Ponte, who had a similar life, is a horribly boring writer. He, like, for instance, can you imagine? He's writing this at the end of his life when Mozart has already been declared an immortal, but he doesn't write more than 3 pages on Mozart. And he remembers nothing of interest about him.
Yeah. We'll just do a couple more and then take questions.
Sure.
So that there's enough time. But I had in mind, when you talked about the imagination and fantasy taking root in the historic fictions, I was curious, thinking back to your first fictions, and in particular those 3 that are often loosely bracketed together as the fantasy or imaginative fictions, Forgetting Elena and Nocturnes and Caracal, which seem to then announce a kind of full stop maybe to that particular scene. But now it sounds as if, you know, fantastic fantasy and imagination takes root again in the different contexts of historical fiction. But would you say something about how, what happened, or how conscious or precise
it was? What happened is that I started to write gay autobiographical fiction, and it felt to me like the subject matter at that point was so new that it was sort of frivolous to also have an avant-garde, complicated, opaque style. I mean, whereas I enjoyed playing with words in my first 2 novels and creating kind of preposterous concatenations of thought. By the time I wrote Boys on Story, I thought, well, it was almost as though I'd been handed this very interesting subject matter, and I thought it would really be frivolous to make it also hard to read. I mean, all you have to do is tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Were there people, as in the case of Stephen Crane, it seems now in hindsight so sort of clear that you were fearless, and you, as you say, you wrote the gay sex manual, you wrote a gay travel book, you wrote the gay auto-fictional trilogy, and in a way sort of created or contributed to the creation of a new genre. Were there people at the time that said, don't do that, don't throw your career away?
Many people. And like my editor at Random House just laughed at me when I told her I was going to do The Joy of Gay Sex, when she said, oh, that's perfect for you, and that meant I'm never going to see you again.
Oh.
And, so a lot of people thought that I was, because my first 2 books had a succeeded esteem, very few sales, but lots of esteem. Mm. And then it was just considered reckless to write about sex. But Americans are so puritanical, they still don't like anything about sex.
But you carried on nonetheless.
I did, yeah.
Because
I found it fascinating to write about sex in a realistic way. I mean, not as pornography, because I think that has to follow certain rules. It uses a very restrained vocabulary, and it must follow a certain rhythm. It's one-handed reading, as they call it. And if it's too complicated, people get irritated because they want to use it as a kind of miracle aid. And but writing about sex realistically, like what actually goes through your head when you're doing it, is still fairly virginal territory, I think. And I thought that that was and usually comic. Because whenever the body fails the spirit, whenever you're not able to do what you imagine you should be doing, that's humorous.
Mm-hmm. One final thing, then we will take questions. At least I did have a final thing. it? Oh, yeah. Just something that's comic and very shrewd in the Paris memoir is the way that you talk about sort of being newly or differently discovered. In the sense, you talk about the translation of Boy's Own Story into French, and you make a number of very shrewd jokes. I mean, they are very funny to say, you know, you talked to French people about French literature, and you said French people had no time for gay literature, even though they invented it. Every great gay author was a French author, every French canonical author was gay, but so on and so on. But when they translated Boy's Own Story, you talk about the how the terms didn't match, and they called it a young American, didn't they? A jeune American.
Well, you can't use the word boy in French because it either sounds like a pedophile's delight or a waiter, garçon. So you can't, and garçonnet maybe, but you can't really say it. So they called it a jeune American, a young American, which I hated. But I wanted them to call it scene de piste, which is like a trailblazer. It's a Boy Scout word in French, meaning trailblazer. And because I was trying to say to them that Boy's Own has a kind of Victorian ring for us.
Yeah.
And that, like, there's a Boy's Own King Arthur and a Boy's Own History of England. It sounds sort of square and old-fashioned. And that's what was the original wit of the title, if there was any. And I wanted to replicate that with a similarly square-sounding Boy's Own type title in French, but they just didn't get it.
Yeah. A lot of critics later found echoes of, you know, that Isherwood novel, A Single Man, and the idea that both titles sort of subtextually were describing or suggesting a kind of universality. You know, Single Man, Boy's Own Story. But Boy's Own Story also means a boy's very particular story, right?
Yeah, of course, my book came out, it came out after, considerably after Isherwood's book, but I hadn't really thought about that, although that book was a tremendous experience for me, maybe one of my A Single Man by Isherwood, because it was really the first book. It came out in 64. And it was like really the first gay book that showed a gay man moving around in society with friends who were straight or gay and who had a real profession. It was a professor in Los Angeles, and who and it didn't bother to tell you how he came to be gay. And all earlier books, or many earlier books, had been forced to explain the ideology of this terrible condition of homosexuality, and that this was one that just accepted it as within the range of normal behavior. And it was very groundbreaking, and I used to ask myself, why was Isherwood so in advance of everybody else? And I think it's because he lived in Berlin in the first wave of gay liberation in the 20s. And he actually lived in the house of the man who invented all, Magnus Hirschfeld. And then secondly, I think his kind of privileged status as a member of the English gentry helped. I mean, because he was in the sense of not so conformist, he sort of thought, well, if I think it, it's good enough for me, it's good enough for everybody. I mean, he had a kind of, not, I won't say arrogance, but a self-confidence that probably, and then third, he lived in California, and World War II was really the breeding ground for modern homosexuality, because there were all these soldiers who were in the war who were afraid they'd be dead the next day. And so you had to seize the day and do whatever. And they had a little bit of money. They were living far from home. And they were all thrown together in a unisex world. So many of the guys who did come out in the war continued to live after the war in California in all those beach communities. And that was sort of the forcing shed for gay identity. And Isherwood lived out there at that time. So I always think those three factors probably molded him to be a person in advance of his times.
Great, great. We touched a lot of bases but missed others, so it's your turn to fill in all the gaps. Please, let's take some questions.
Oh, yes.
Philip.
It is in relation to the memoir, the kind of the full autobiography, is there something more liberating about writing a series of memoirs? It's time back to about the fact that we're always in the act of becoming, as you were, stage of becoming. So does the memoir, it captures at a certain moment in time, you might need to pick this later on, whereas an autobiography forces some kind of coherence to the life, doesn't it, perhaps? And it's a single person going through stages, as opposed to different people at different stages. So I don't know if you give that thought, but I was just interested, is there something more flexible?
Yes. Well, I wrote a memoir called My Lives, plural, and I didn't want to do it chronologically, and I wanted to do it by topics, like my shrinks, my blondes, my mother, my father, whatever. And I think that one thing is that it made me do is I had written about those things quite a bit already in novels, but when I singled these things out as topics, I felt obliged to say what I really thought about something. I mean, for instance, like I spent 25 years on the couch being psychoanalyzed, and most of it painful and useless, wasted time. But I kept trying to think, was there anything I gained from it? And so anyway, I discussed the pros and cons in a kind of essayistic way that I wouldn't have bothered with. And then I wrote a chapter on my women, and because I've always had very close friendships, even love affairs with women, and I tried to think about that as a subject, and what did I really think about it, and tried to be as honest as I could be. So yes, you're quite right that I think in a memoir you can accept that you're different people at different times, and that you don't try to round everything off.
Yes. I was kind of thinking about Hardy's, supposed autobiography, where everything's very carefully crafted to kind of give an impression about who he was. It's a very crafted, very studied sort of thing.
Yes.
Whereas that's a memoir allows you not to have that self, in a way that that's sort of, that's that sense of what you're putting down there is the final word on yourself.
I think Hardy is so much more honest in his poems.
Yeah, he is.
Because he's willing to talk about all the misery of his first marriage and stuff. I mean, whereas I think Victorians and Edwardians were pretty much committed to drawing a heroic portrait of themselves. Or, like in their biographies, Tennyson's son wrote a biography of his father, and that, has to be hagiographic. You can't just... Well, now we've gone too far the other way in what Joyce Carol Oates calls pathographies, and that we only write about how sick everybody is and how they were abusing their children, what monsters they were, like Frost. The biographies of Frost only stress what a nut he was. But, which I think that's too far the other way.
You said in Inside a Pearl, you suggested that the French have no time for that. That, if Americans or British people talked about, their in unjust childhoods or abuse, the French would just shut people up and say,
no, we've all had bad. Pas de conversion, yeah. We all had a miserable childhood, don't talk about it.
Yeah. Curious. So, another question.
Yes.
This wasn't the question that I meant to ask, but it's provoked by the comment that you made about prose writers making poor playwrights. Do you think the reverse is true, that those dramatists who attempt prose writing often find the same problem?
I don't
problem?
Think so. I mean, maybe. I mean, like, I read a wonderful sort of... memoir, I guess, or an autobiographical novel that Ionesco wrote. I mean, Ionesco's greatest fear was dying, and he was obsessed with it in a way that we all worry about it from time to time, but we don't think about it 24 hours a day. But he did. He was just obsessed. He was in a cold sweat about the idea he was going to be dead. And of course, that energized a lot of his plays, like The Rhinoceros. but he was able to render it very well, I thought, in prose too. But what do you think?
Well, I, in putting that question to you, the only contemporary American example that I can think of a playwright who moved into prose or written in prose was David Mamet.
Yes.
And I'm insufficiently familiar with the field to say more than that.
But do you like his prose, or...?
Not as much as I like his playwright.
Yeah. And isn't it often short stories in dramas that, you know, Chekhov, Tennessee Williams...
I mean, what's interesting is that Tennessee Williams, in his plays, you feel there's a constant commercial pressure to have a hit, which means that it can't be too gay or too bizarre or too anything. And so the short stories, he'll write very weird short stories, like Desire and The Black Masseur, is all about a man who falls in love with his masseur and who eventually kills him and eats him. And, you know, but you can't show that on the stage. At least not with the same actor. And I think, in general, that, I mean, I think Williams was always kind of haunted by the bizarre and the violent, but and there, in something like Streetcar Named Desire, there's a big rape scene and there's a lot of violence, but it's still muted in not as extravagant as in the stories, because the stories are, but the stories are wonderful. He has a great story called it's about a man and a woman, two on a party, and it's a funny phrase, but it's about a man and a woman who decide to travel all through the South together in a bright red convertible, both cruising, looking for men. The man is looking for them, and so is the woman, and of course the man gets beat up a lot, but he sort of likes that. Anyway, the man and the woman are actually in love with each other, but they can't really announce that to each other. But they have this wonderful companionship as they're both looking for men. And again, that would, maybe you could make that into a movie now. Maybe not, but it would be hard to put it on the stage. I think also because something that I said about novels needing to be representative, I think that plays, after all, theater is a public art form where you're very conscious of the people sitting around you and that this is somehow a community coming together to look at a play, going back to ancient Greek times, and where there was a religious aspect to it too. But I think that things that are too far out or too violent or bizarre are irritating on the stage.
Talking of which, you put the last play, Terhot, you put Gore Vidal into a play, so how is that?
I wrote a play about Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma bomber who killed all those people, and then in prison he began a correspondence with Gore Vidal, because Gore had defended him in print. And so he liked the articles that Gore had written, and so he began to exchange letters with him. And I imagine that the two of them meeting shortly before McVeigh was executed. And Gore, actually, his real opinions are much more extreme than the ones I gave to the character, because, again, I sort of wanted to normalize him and have him have a kind of ordinary horror when he finally confronts what this man has done, like kill all these children and so on. And Gore was very extreme about it, and oh no, you know, he wanted to defend him to the hilt and said such crazy things to me that if I put those on stage, the character would have elicited no sympathy at all. So I remember Gore's own agent said to me, "I don't know why Gore's so upset about this play. Your character is much nicer than he is."
You're a public service.
Yeah.
Another question.
I just wanted to ask you about became a disciplined writer, or really, has your writing practice changed over time? Where you, I think about me, of course, in one level. At one stage, I was very dedicated to get up every morning, 6 o'clock, and write, and then go to work, and this kind of thing. But I was also reflecting on the way that daydreaming is a part of writing as well. This is a part that we don't think about, but actually is a part of writing.
Yes.
Imagining is producing as well. But do you have a practice of some kind, or do you, when you're talking at lunch, do you have times when you think, I'm going away now to work on that particular book? You know, do you have writing holidays, as it were, or business holidays?
Well, I'm a very undisciplined writer, and I would rather do almost anything than write. Certainly, I like to cook or talk on the phone or go to a dinner with somebody. But I'm always in a panic because I'm always broke, so I'm always writing to finish to get the next installment of my payments, and so that keeps me writing poverty and. I write longhand, and then I dictate it to a secretary, and usually I try to choose a very intelligent secretary who will wince when I write something really stupid, and so then that kind of wince factor makes me rewrite and make it sound better. I try to make things sound better, but I've had very clever secretaries who think, wait a minute, her eyes were green 20 pages before, now they're blue. And, so it helps. And it's nice also because you can dictate an entire book in the space of 10 days, so you can hear it all, which is, I think, valuable to get a sense of, because whereas a poem, you can feel your way around the whole thing. A novel is sort of bewilderingly long, and even for the writer. I think that one reason that writers, I think, follow rather strict forms in constructing a novel is because the very building blocks that they're working with are so cloudy and kind of elusive. They themselves can't remember it. I mean, like, I wrote this wacky novel called Caracal that he mentioned, and Richard mentioned, and I never could get to the bottom of that. I was always reading it again and again, thinking, what have I done? But it's not a very good, it's really a terrible novel, but...
Best novel.
See?
Well, thank you.
I mean, it has its fans, that novel.
It does.
Sincerely. But just to clarify, you write longhand and you correct somewhat longhand, but dictate once the thing is done, right? The dictation process isn't immediate.
And then I fool around on the computer once it's all been entered into the computer. Mm. I keep rewriting and fussing with it.
From the money point of view, it's good to write longhand, isn't it? Because of the archives and you get paid.
Yeah, you can sell it.
We know one novelist who writes by computer, but... you know, then chose to write longhand in a kind of inventive way because otherwise you don't get any money.
Do you use a pencil or a pen?
Pen.
Yeah, a fancy pen?
Fancy paper, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just bought myself a new pen, so it's
a very good.
But Balzac wrote for money, didn't he? That's a kind of object lesson. You can write a lot if you have no money.
Yeah.
That's a great tip for budding writers. Just make sure you're poor and it will come out.
Right, and Genet would write a manuscript and then sell that, and then write another manuscript of the same book and sell that. Yeah, I mean, he's such a crook.
And he didn't even know the University of Austin, Texas at the time.
No, but I was joking, but it is a sincere truth. There are creative writers that write on keyboards and now construct or fabricate written versions so that there's an archive that they can... We won't mention who that is.
There's a man from Sotheby's who comes to evaluate my manuscripts. Yeah, that's great. And he loves my stuff because it's all written by him.
Absolutely.
And he says, you know, nobody wants to buy a readout of a computer.
That's right.
Although they are beginning to.
I think we're out of time, realistically. There's a cab coming in about 9 minutes. So I think we'll just have to thank Ed for coming. Line up if you want to buy the book, and I'm sure Ed can sign it. And thank you all so much for coming. Thanks, Ed, for your time.